And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper is recovering from his back injury, and he is making good progress. Mental illness has largely been concealed in a cloak of shame and secrecy. Although much research has been conducted in recent decades and many breakthroughs in new medications have been made, bipolar affective disorder affects approximately 5.7 million American adults, and the median age of onset is 25 years of age. Our guest, Joan Childs, is a practicing psychotherapist. So was her daughter, Pamela Glassman, who suffered with and succumbed to bipolar disorder when she died in 1998. Even with their joint credentials and medical knowledge, Pamela could not be saved. Joan Childs is the author of Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder. We welcome you, Joan E. Childs.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And we need that E because it's listed on all your websites and everything, right?
Right, that's correct. It's Joan E.
Joan E. Okay, that's Joan and the letter E. Let me express first my deep sympathy at the loss of Pamela. I'm very, very sorry. And I hope that something good is coming out of your book for you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Do you believe that the stigma of mental illness is still as it was 16 years ago?
I don't really think the stigma is as bad as it was 16 years ago, but because I think it's starting to come out of the woodwork, and I don't know anyone that doesn't know someone who has mental illness. It's pretty pervasive in our culture, if not our culture, all over the world, except that in America, we are hearing more and more about mental illness than perhaps 16 years ago. What I don't think has changed very much has been the substandard health system and how it's treated. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
Do you think there is more help available now than there was, though?
Yes.
For those who suffer?
I think there is. At that time when she passed away, we didn't have a place, South Florida Hospital, psychiatric hospital, was not even open. So we really didn't have a place where she needed to go, which would have been a long-term care. There were several hospitalizations, but they didn't last very long, perhaps 2 days, 3 days, often making things worse rather than better.
You mean they wouldn't keep her longer than 2 or 3 days?
Right. That was part of the problem, was because that was really sort of the inception of the HMO, when they would have a criteria to only allow patients to have a certain amount of days depending upon their illness or how they were evaluated, but never longer than 2 or 3 days. And then they were discharged. Many times she was discharged in a psychotic state. Mm-hmm. But she was not considered suicidal, so that's why they were allowed to discharge her. However, what they didn't realize was that when you're in a psychotic state, as she was, you could have a delusionary demand, which is to jump out of a window, which is exactly what happened.
Well, why don't we talk a little about bipolar disorder? It's also known as manic depressive illness. I guess it used to be called that.
That's
more
correct.
Frequently. What is it exactly? And let's start there.
Well, it's today it's considered a spectrum. It's kind of like the autistic spectrum. It goes from bipolar 2, which is the least of the bipolars, all the way to bipolar 1. I think there may be two more now that I just heard about, four types. But in my understanding, there's bipolar 1 and bipolar 2. It's a mental illness that has to do with the neurotransmitters in the brain, which really stabilize certain chemicals, the kind that keep you up when you're excited, the dopamine, and the kind that keep you stable or quiet when you're supposed to be, which is really the serotonin level. In someone that's bipolar, they have mood changes, and they can be rapid mood changes within hours of each other. They can last for days or weeks, and sometimes even months. They go from depression to mania or from mania to depression. That's why it comes out of the manic depressive disorder. But today it has been put on a spectrum, and bipolar 1 as opposed to bipolar 2 is far worse, because in bipolar 1 there is a psychotic break which causes hallucinations, both auditory and visual. And the comorbidity, meaning how it mimics so many other mental illnesses, such as schizophrenia, is hard to make what they call a differential diagnosis. So it took a long time for Pam's diagnosis to be made.
You know, I was very surprised. I learned that when I read your book about the delusions and the hallucinations and the psychotic break. I had no idea that that was a part of this bipolar
one.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so when was Pamela first diagnosed?
She was first diagnosed when she was 24 years old. Her roommates in California, where she lived and worked, had called me, and they told me that she was delusional and out of control, psychotic. And so when we brought her back here to South Florida, I put her in she was seen by her first psychiatrist who diagnosed her, Dr. Flemmenbaum, who's still practicing, I believe. And he put her in the retreat at the time. The retreat was a stabilization, some sort of a inpatient unit where she could be treated. And it was there she was treated for 2 weeks, stabilized, and walked out as if nothing had ever happened, and wanted to immediately return to her PhD program, which I tried very hard to tell her to take off some time. But she went right back into that almost a manic stage. It was a sort of like just before you get manic, a pre-manic stage, for lack of another word. Mm-hmm. But she was racing to go back. She wanted to complete her program. And against my better wishes, she went back, and it wasn't long after that she had another manic episode. And the manic episode usually is coupled with a psychotic break. But she was 24 at the time that she had her first break.
Well, let me ask you, when she saw that doctor and she was put in the retreat, for 2 weeks?
Yes.
Was she given medication?
Yes.
Medication? Was she put on medication?
Immediately. And that's what stabilized her. She was put on an antidepressant, and she was put on, I'm trying to remember now, an antipsychotic. The drugs then are different than they are today. They're a little more sophisticated today. Mm-hmm. And there are more of them for the same reasons, because individuals are so unique that the response for one drug doesn't actually have the same effect for everybody. So it's a hit and miss. It still is a hit and miss, by the way. It was then, and it is now. So psychiatry or psychopharmacology plays with the psychotropic medication to see what works for each person.
Right. I imagine that's very difficult, and I imagine each medication takes time, I would think, to work before you can tell if it's working.
Right. It takes approximately 2 to 3 weeks to really get into the bloodstream and for you to see the effects, if they're positive or negative. And most of these drugs, with my daughter anyway, and a lot of other people, they put you to sleep for hours if you're on them. And so many people who are diagnosed with bipolar don't like to be in that lethargic place.
Right.
So that's when they become non-compliant with the medication and the psychiatrist. So that's why there's so much upheaval, and it's so difficult to stabilize them, because they don't like the effects of the medication.
Of course. So did Pam take her medication as she was instructed, or you don't know?
I don't know. Obviously she didn't, because she was certainly not responding in a positive way, but she faked it so well. I mean, she was a master of overcompensation. She was brilliant, beautiful, and she was able to somehow just sabotage herself and convince her mental health doctors and therapists that she was really okay. And so she really pulled it off many times. One particular time that I had taken her to Israel, which is in the book, and she didn't even take her medicine with her. So that was a nightmare, trying to find a psychiatrist in Israel that could get her the equivalent of the medicine that she was on here. It took us a while to do it, but she really would self-sabotage and look like she was taking it. I would actually watch her. She'd put the pill in her mouth. Somehow she would dislodge it somewhere, and when I was walk away, she would take it out. I didn't ever see that, but it was obvious to me that it wasn't effective, so she must have not taken it. Sometimes she did, but when she did, she wouldn't get up for hours and days. She was extremely lethargic. And when she did take it, that's when she would have lucid moments. So it was really a very rocky, unstabilizing time for both of us.
It makes me wonder if she wasn't taking her medication, if she would have gone into a long-term care facility had one been available.
Well, we'll never know.
We'll never know.
No, we don't know. I did try to get her placements, but she never seemed to meet the criteria. Her HMO health insurance, it was just... it just didn't have enough of what they needed to get her stabilized properly. I tried getting her into a different institutions such as Menninger and the Karen, but she just never met the criteria for what they needed.
Do you think that's because she was able to fake that she was better than she was, the way you've described? Or
That might have been partially it, but some of them she never even got to have an interview with. I was kind of like taking over for her, just trying to call different places. And listen, I'm a licensed clinical social worker. Right. I've been here practicing for 37 years. I have a network of psychiatrists and therapists. My ex-husband, is a physician. And it was like all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put her back together again. She was a broken person, and beautiful and brilliant, and a PhD, worked for the John Bradshaw Institute out in California, which he was like the golden boy of recovery. Mm-hmm. He was actually the proponent for the movement of the inner child, right, which I became the first affiliate. So she had every possibility and every advantage of being taken care of. Had she not had us as her family, she would have been homeless. Because this is what you see out there, are homeless people who are not lazy, but mentally ill.
We're speaking with Joan E. Childs. She's a practicing psychotherapist in South Florida. And she's written, Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder. We're going to take a short break on today's Topical Currents, and we'll be back and ask for your calls and your emails. Stay with us. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Joan E. Childs. She's a practicing psychotherapist, a licensed clinical social worker, and has been since 1978 in South Florida. And she's written, Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder. If you have a question for Joan Childs, if you have an experience as a parent of a child with bipolar disorder, if you suffer from the disease, if you're coping with a loss of a child or loss in general, you can call us 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. So Joan, I during the break, I was just wondering, has the Affordable Care Act made any accommodations for mental illness that you're aware of? Has that changed anything?
I think it's too soon to really know that yet. I haven't had any personal interaction with it,
okay.
So I don't know from my own personal experience. I certainly hope it does.
I want to go back to Pam's first, when she had that first psychotic break, is that what it was called, or psychotic
manic episode, break, yes.
And it was 24, and as I read in the introduction, usually the onset of bipolar disorder is average age is 25.
Right.
Was there some event, was it the pressure of getting a PhD, was there something in her life going on that triggers it, or does it not work that way?
I think every case is different. As I said, she was living in L.A. at the time. I think there were mitigating circumstances that were probably contributing to the illness showing itself. I think what happened that actually brought it to a head was that Pam never used drugs or alcohol. She was a purist. She was mixing vegetables, lettuce, tomatoes in a mixmaster before it ever became chic to do mm-hmm. so. So she was a non-drinker, and she never used drugs. But there was this one time, and I think this might have been the precipitating moment when it caused the disease to to emerge. She had smoked some marijuana. She had been in this place in Venice Beach or mm-hmm. some place that was extremely avant-garde. I don't know what other word to use, esoteric maybe. And it was called Dance Home, and she met a man, and somehow this man went home with her, and she took a puff, a toke, as they would say, of a joint, and that precipitated probably something that was already predetermined. It mm-hmm. was a pre-existing, or not pre-existing, but something that was underlying. And it caused her to go into a manic episode where she did have the psychotic break simultaneously and lost contact with reality, running through the streets of where she lived, the community where she lived, screaming for help. And her roommate saw her running out frantically and called an ambulance, 911, and they came and took her to the emergency room of the hospital, the first time that she was ever seen in that moment of the break. The emergency room doctor called it a drug-induced psychotic break episode, and he just said that she needed to see a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. She had been seeing one for years, by the way. So she was under the care of a therapist and a psychiatrist. From the time she went to college, University of Missouri, she started seeing a counselor immediately when she went there. So that might have been the precipitating incident that occurred. However, she had a predisposition, obviously, because it's a genetic illness. Or if it's not that, she had a very traumatic birth, a frank breech, which means the rear end first, not even head first. And it was a labor and a delivery that was traumatic for both of us. That might have been one of the contributing factors. Maybe it was genetic as well. But she had been showing signs of mental illness previous to that precipitating event that it was hard for us to discern. Certainly for me, because I was 3,000 miles away. But I would be getting these frantic calls in the middle of the night because of the three-hour difference. She was hysterical over the earthquakes that seemed to start coming so rapidly one after the other. And it was probably a metaphor for her of how she was mm-hmm. feeling on the inside. It was an expression on the outside. But her symptoms were there even from this age of 16. But when you live with somebody, and she was my first child, you know, I had no frame of reference. It was hard to discern that there was something psychologically going on. I couldn't tell. She seemed to be fine at moments. She was a high school cheerleader. She was popular. She had boyfriends. She had girlfriends. Everybody loved her. At home, she could go from being the sweetest, the kindest, the most loving, caring daughter and sibling to her other brothers and sisters to completely frenetic, out of control, angry, mean, almost as if there were two people living in her, and I never know what to expect. I'd come home, it was like a minefield. I never knew when she was going to blow up. So we didn't really, you know, when you're a family member and you're living with somebody, you go into sort of a denial that you don't want to see what you really see.
Right. Yeah, I was going to ask you that, because you say in the book that you were blinded to a lot of the symptoms early on, and I wondered how much denial plays a part because you don't want to see it in your own
right.
child.
Well, that's definitely one of the reasons. The other reason, from my own personal experience, I was a clinical therapist at the time. I was in private practice, and I had four other children. And sometimes you just don't really pay attention to these things because your life is so, you're trying to juggle so many different.
Right.
I remember when I used to give lectures on managing motherhood and career, and I was out there saying, you know, superwoman type thing. And now if I had to give those lectures, it would be just the opposite. I would say, if you're going to be a career woman, don't expect to manage both. You're going to do one well and the other one not so well. And something's got to give. So if you want to be a great career woman, don't expect to be a great mother, and vice versa. It's really a choice. And we aren't super women. So in the midst of trying to earn a living, raise the five children, all, by the way, were teenagers at the time. I had 5 and 8 years. You don't see, you don't have eyes in the back of your head, so it's impossible not only to see what's going on, but to try to understand what's going on when you're in the midst of it yourself. You can't be objective.
But she still managed to get her PhD. She still managed to become a practicing psychotherapist. So she, yes, on some level, she functioned very well.
Very well, very well. She, like I said, she was brilliant. She had the capacity to overcompensate in many ways for what she couldn't do. You would never recognize it because she could do other things so well. She was always so present for people. She never turned anybody away if they had a problem. They would go to her and they would feel like they were the only person in the world. And that was true not of just her patients, her clients, but of her friends and her family. So she had this ability to be both and, almost what would be a comorbidity with schizophrenia or even a multiple personality, which she wasn't. That's mm-hmm. what bipolar does. It just mimics other right. illnesses.
I guess that's why it's so hard to diagnose.
Very difficult to have a differential diagnosis. It takes interviews. We don't have blood tests. We don't have MRIs, brain scanning. You really can't see whether, you know, what's going on in there. So it takes a really polished psychiatrist, psychopharmacologist to be able to ask the right questions. And I think the family, it is a systemic thing. So I think the family sometimes must be involved in the process to see our perspective in order to really get a clinical differential diagnosis.
How did her chosen career path affect her illness? And how did her illness affect her chosen career path?
Those are great questions, Bonnie. The first, which was how was she able to handle her chosen field? This is what was so remarkable about her. John Bradshaw actually called her a wizard therapist. She would draw the lightning to herself. She was able to take she dealt with a lot of adult children of dysfunctional families or adult children of alcoholics, children who had been abused, children who had been neglected or abandoned, who were now grown-ups. So this is an adult child she would deal with. That's what mainly the program was at the Institute of John Bradshaw. So these adult children had been survivors of all this abuse, whether it had been sexual or whether their parent was an alcoholic or physically abusive, sexually abusive, spiritually abusive, intellectually abusive, emotionally, verbally, whatever. As she was dealing with the broken souls or the wounded children that were living in the inside of these adult children. So there was a lot of pain and sorrow and shame. Shame was like covering everything. She had the ability to draw that out, to draw the lightning to herself, and just sort of like do an exorcism. This was done at the Institute at John Bradshaw with several patients. They adored her. They thought she walked on water. I mean, her reputation in California was well known at the time. She managed to do it, and one of the, I think this sort of now segues into the other part of your question. When you do that kind of work, you really have to have strong boundaries mm-hmm. as a therapist. You have to know where you end and your client or patient starts.
Right.
And that's where it got messed up. I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Green Mile, which was about a prisoner. Okay,
I know a little about it, but I never saw it, no.
It was metaphoric where this prisoner could really kind of suck the venom out of the other prisoners and then spit out the poison. It was really a metaphor of what she was doing. She would take on their pain and she would somehow manage to get them to release it, but she had to be the conduit in the middle of it.
But was she able to spit it out?
Well, that's the problem, is that, and that's what we all are looking at, we have been looking at, is that her boundary, she was only in her early 20s when she was working there. And she really didn't have yet she wasn't equipped to be able to protect herself from some of the toxic shame and the pain of her clients that she was dealing with. She took it on, but she couldn't release it. So that was one of the mitigating circumstances or the contributing factors to the problem, is that she was doing God's work, so to speak, in a way that she wasn't prepared to do it. nobody saw this, not even at the Institute. They praised her. They glorified her. And the more that they said wonderful things, the adulation and the positive feedback she got, the more that she was doing it. Her identity became fused, or you want to call it confused, if you want to, with the therapist and the person and the client or the patient. So it really contributed, I think, to her breakdown.
So we're speaking with Joan E. Childs, and she's a practicing psychotherapist in South Florida. She's written Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder on today's Topical Currents. Is it common for this disease to get worse and worse, it seems like, or do you think it was her work that was making her worse, or is this the way that this disease progresses?
Well, that's a very good question, too. The answer to that is all the bipolar people that I have ever treated, and there hasn't been that many, so you can't use me as an example, but if you look in the correlation between bipolar 1, which was her diagnosis, and suicide, it's a very high correlation.
I saw that.
Yeah, very, very high. So, and you don't know. You don't know that it's going to happen. I certainly didn't know. I spoke to her only 2 days before, and I asked her the question that I was always afraid to ask her, and this was just 2 days before she killed herself. It was a Tuesday, and I spoke to her in the evening. I was in Wisconsin. She was down here in Florida, and I asked her, Pammy, I said, listen, I want to know how things are going for you, because she was left alone with her father and her father's girlfriend at the time. Her support system was gone, my two other daughters who she had lived with at the time. And the reason she lived with them was because she was afraid to live with me. I had become, in her mind, a demonic force also. Mm. She had shared with me that, Mom, I know this is part of my illness, and I know it's going to sound crazy, but I can't be with you anymore because I see demons around you.
So she knew it was part of her illness.
That's what made the differential diagnosis, because in schizophrenia, they can't get that as easily.
Right,
they
right.
can't get it. That the movie The Beautiful Mind showed you that. A beautiful mind that is pervasive in schizophrenia. But in bipolar, you can be very lucid. She had the most lucid conversation with me 2 days before she jumped. She said to me, I said to her, I'm a little nervous that your sisters are away in North Carolina and I'm going down to North Carolina. And I know your father can take care of you, but you need to be near your psychiatrist. But I'm a little anxious because we have been your support system. I spoke to her every day, but she didn't want to sleep in my house. I said, I have to ask you a question that's very hard for me to ask you, but I really need to know this. Have you ever thought about suicide? And I talked to her just like I'm talking to you right now, Bonnie. Her answer was so lucid, and she said, Mom, let me give you some reassurance. I'll never forget her words. She said, I would never take my life because, for the first reason, I would never leave a legacy like that to you, Daddy, and my siblings. I love them too much. I love you and Daddy. The second reason that I would never do it, she said, because you've always told me that this belief system I have is crazy, that the devil's going to take my soul. If I kill myself, it's like handing it to him. And the third reason is I'm Jewish, and we don't do things like that. We don't kill ourselves. We're not allowed to. And I want to go to heaven if I die and when I die, but I'm certainly not going to do myself. So that was the convincing argument.
That was 2 days before.
That was a Tuesday night, 2 days before. However, the intuitive part of me, or maybe the maternal intuitive goddess, whatever you want to call it, the Demeter, the goddess of motherhood, I didn't feel good about it, even though she sounded convincing and tried very hard to reassure me. Was very lucid. I picked up the phone the following morning and I called her psychiatrist, who I had been with her to see. And I asked her to please hospitalize her. I said, I know she's not suicidal, but I'm worried because our whole support system is gone, her support system. So she said to me, look, I'm going to see her tomorrow, which would have been Thursday, and I'll evaluate her, but I don't think she's suicidal. I just saw her last week. She's psychotic, she told me, but she's not suicidal. I said, I know she's psychotic and not suicidal, but when you're psychotic, you can get a delusionary demand to go kill, jump out the window. And I called it right on it. Mm. I was almost like a witch. I had had a dream 10 years before that that was going to happen. But I never thought, you know, it never stayed in my conscious mind every day. But this, I called her and she said, I'm going to see her tomorrow. I'll evaluate her and I'll determine if she is. I said, do me a favor and put her in the hospital anyway. And her response was the response I got all the time. She won't meet the criteria for hospitalization. I said, because her insurance won't pay for it. I said, okay, then override the insurance. Her father and I will take care of it. So she said, okay. Well, she never made it to Thursday morning. She died at 11 o'clock. Her appointment was at 1. So you never know. I mean, it was a crapshoot, basically. I went through the what ifs. What if I had taken her with me to North Carolina? What if I, had put her in the hospital before I left? What if I didn't have cell phones in those days? It was 1998. It was pre-cell phone era. So the what ifs came about from that. It's a long story that goes what happened to me when I found out. I was right. The last to find out. But that was really a shock to all of us. We all knew she was crazy, but we did never thought that she would ever do anything like that.
Let's take a couple of calls.
Sure.
Because let's talk to Lee in Fort Lauderdale, who has a question about his daughter. Hi, Lee. Welcome.
Thank you very much. This is a program that I hope other people are enjoying and learning from it. I've had a daughter that is bipolar, and she's a manic. Since she was 16 years old, she was diagnosed. She was put in the hospital for 2 months when she was 16. She's now 50 years old. She refuses to take medication. When she took medication, she leveled out, and everything was fine. But she said it stifled her creativity. Mm-hmm. Well, she's achieved 2 master's degrees, cannot hold down a job, mm-hmm. and basically lives in genteel poverty. But she is happy because she has found religion, and she has as happy as anybody I know, according to her. But she is not considered suicidal, but she has just no grip on anything reality-based. Mm-hmm. She's in an entirely other world than we are, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult.
Well, there's a wonderful book called An Unquiet Mind by Kay Jamison Redfield, who happens to be the chief of psychology at Johns Hopkins University and wrote this book. She herself has the same disease. Now, remember when I started the program, I spoke about the fact that it is on a spectrum, bipolar 1 versus bipolar 2. And recently I heard there may be 2 other types. I'm not familiar with them, though. Your daughter may have bipolar 2, which in a way is a blessing and a curse at the same time. A blessing because chances are, like you said, she's happy and she's alive. And that may be the best that she can do in this lifetime, and you may have to come to terms with that and accepting that that is her handicap, as if we have to accept if your child had cancer or heart disease. This may be her limitation. Redfield Jamison, who wrote this book, An Unquiet Mind, she's chief of psychology at Johns Hopkins, she manages on medication. It works for her. There are people that do exactly what your daughter does, that choose not to take it because they feel that it interrupts their creativity and stalls them out. So they choose not to do it, and unfortunately, they don't really fit in. It interferes with their quality of life, according to you and I. But to them, they take the position of being happy. And if that's what she's done, be grateful that she hasn't killed herself. I don't know that.
I am so appreciative of talking to you, and I agree with you. But it makes it very difficult, because she does some outrageous things that it's hard for the family to grasp at times.
That is one of the hardest things. It's not just the patient. the client or the person that's struggling, and it is a it is a struggling illness because you can't really interact with the world when you behave like that. But the family members have the hardest time because there's nothing we can do. We are completely powerless over this. And I think it's kind of like the first step of the 12-step program, which says, I'm powerless over my daughter's illness and her behavior, and I have to come to terms with it, whether it's accepting a higher power, God as you know God, or peace as you know peace within yourself, the universe. But it really is, you are powerless, and the only thing you can do is to really come to terms with the fact that you are powerless and helpless over it.
Thank you, Lee, and we wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Did you have another thing you wanted to say?
The only thing I wanted to say is the family wanted to put her into an institution for the time being because she was having problems a couple of years at different times. And they would not take her because she was an adult. She had to sign herself in and sign herself out. They would not accept the fact that we as a family could sign her in. Mm. She was an adult. She was her own person.
Well, the way this...
And I think that was unfortunate.
It is, because we are allowed to be crazy. We're not allowed to kill ourselves or kill other people. But unless somebody volunteers or can really have a conscious commitment to getting help, it's very hard. You have to prove that they are really incapable, incompetent and incapable, and that would require some legal action on your part. But that's something that's out of my realm, so I don't really want to give you any advice on something that I don't know well enough.
Well, I do appreciate that. And they said, two questions they asked me, is she homicidal or is she suicidal?
Right.
And she was neither.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
that was that for them.
Okay, Lee, well, we wish you the very best.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. We're speaking with Joan E. Childs, a practicing psychotherapist in South Florida, who's written Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder. We need to take a break, and we'll come back and take more of your calls, so stay with us. And thank you for joining us for Topical Currents. Welcome back. We're speaking with Joan E. Childs, a practicing psychotherapist in South Florida, about her book, Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder. And we're going to take more calls. I'm going to ask all of you if you please can be as brief as possible because we don't have much time, but we do have a lot of calls. And I want to get Kim's question. Kim, welcome. You're on Topical Currents.
Hello. Thank you. I feel badly for your daughter, but I suppose part of me knows that she's out of pain, which we watch our stepdaughter as well as four of my friends, one with schizophrenic, one with borderline personality disorder, another one who has a child who is diagnosed as ADHD, that we don't think that's the correct diagnosis. So getting it diagnosed is difficult, and these are adult children. So I guess what my question is in the past, Florida had Chattahoochees where you put people who had problems and they weren't well run and they were destroyed in the 50s and 60s, and we got a lot of homeless from that. But nowadays, our one child was suicidal, and the Baker Act only keeps them in 48 hours.
That's correct.
Right.
Then they can check themselves out. All of these, they have the ability to check themselves out no matter what you do.
Right.
You can't force them to stay, and I find it really frustrating and heartbreaking that you can't help your child.
Right. No, that's exactly my point. That's one of the points in the book, is that our health system is still substandard, and we really have to do something to correct this. Otherwise, it's just going to be, it's 16 years since my daughter passed, and really nothing has changed in terms of what are we going to do about this situation? And so I totally imbibe what you're saying, and I have the same concerns for all the other callers and people that are out there that are struggling with this insidious disease and their families. It's a sense of powerlessness.
I'm sorry, Kim, and thank you for calling.
You're welcome.
Carla. Okay, Carla in Miami. Again, we are a little bit short on time, but we ask you to go ahead.
Hello, that would be me?
Yes.
Hi. I feel the pain. I am the parent of an adult son with schizophrenia. I applaud you for exposing how bad mental health care is, especially here in Miami-Dade. I and five other parents about 7 years ago got together and saw that there was nothing for our adult children here in the way of continuum of care after hospitalization, and we opened the Key Clubhouse of South Florida. We've been open for 4 years, and we're successful, but we're one small little clubhouse servicing. We've serviced over 200 people. I look forward to collaborating with Miss Child, Dr. Childs, is it?
Or no, it's Joan Childs. I'm a licensed clinical social worker.
I hope we'll be able to collaborate with you going forward, because we've been strongly advocating for better mental health care. One of our peers' son jumped off a balcony and died after his mother begged Jackson Hospital to keep him there.
Yes, this is pervasive.
This was 2 years ago. Mm. And my own son voluntarily just came home from 7 months at National Institute of Mental Health in Bethesda. And even though I've been all over the community in the last 7 years trying to get things in place for the day when he'll be able to take part or take advantage of a healing place, there still is none. I'm working on it, but there's still
good for you. Good for you. Keep working.
The clubhouse model, I'll just say one more thing about that. I did call to tout my clubhouse, but not for us, but for the fact that people need to know that the mental health care system is completely broken, and all the funding goes to jails and crisis intervention units instead of creating the community-based facilities that will actually provide our children the continuum of care that's critical here.
Well, keep getting the message out, because it needs to be heard.
And I hope Bonnie will have us on soon, too.
Okay, Carla, send an email.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Speaking of all of this, you told me something. I think this is something you just found out, Joan, that you have this series. You'll be moderating it, Books and Books, Coping with Mental Illness, Four Perspectives, that came out of your presentation of this book, Why Did She Jump, at Books and Books.
That's right.
Tell us about the series.
Well, this just, like you said, I just learned about this last night for sure, that we're starting September 21st at Books and Books in Coral Gables. We're going to have a panel discussion group. It's called You're Not Alone, Coping with Mental Illness, Four Perspectives. So I will be moderating with a psychiatrist, a counselor, either a psychologist or a mental health counselor, a patient and a family member, where we can open this up and get it out of the woodwork so people can come and learn, be educated, find resources, and the community can just be more aware of mental illness and where they can go to get the help that they need. Books and Books is hosting it. I'm going to be moderating it. And it all came very serendipitously when Ana Veciana Suarez wrote this wonderful article in the Miami Herald on July 8th. I appeared July 9th in a terrible rainstorm. I never expected anybody to show up. They had set up 75 chairs, and it was raining. I didn't expect more than 30 people, and there were over 130 people that came. So out of this terrible tragedy of losing my daughter, writing the book, which is now becoming a movie, by the way, comes Books and Books, who is going to host and put it out there so the community has an awareness. And that's starting, but the first one will be September 21st.
At Books and Books in Coral
Gables. It's a Sunday. I think it's at 4 in the afternoon, but they can call me or write or email, and I'll let them know.
Okay, and you have your website, joanechilds.com.
That's it, yes.
And Books and Books, I'm sure, will have it on their website.
Right.
Let's talk about writing the book briefly, since we're almost out of time. How has this healed you?
It was a catharsis. I was compelled to write it. Grievers are nocturnal. I couldn't sleep. I had to go to work every day because I had to make a living. I had to support myself. I had four other kids. I was alone at the time. I was living alone. All my other children were either in school or out of school on their own. So I was just, it was like a muse came in at night and just pushed me to the computer, and I just started discharging my feelings, writing them like a journal. And after 7 years, I realized, wow, this could be a book. This could help other people. I have patients who I could give it to. and help them see that this is my experience, that I'm here, I am a social worker, a clinician. And
it, did that make it harder for you, the fact that you were a psychotherapist, that you were unable to help? Do you have extra...
Well, I used to say to myself, why couldn't I have been more effective? Because I do have the tools. But I have given up that kind of guilt and those feelings of the what ifs, or I should have, could have, you know, ought to. All that is gone now, thank God, because I know that in my heart of hearts, I did everything that I could do, as did her father, with the limitations that he had, because even though he was a physician, he really wasn't familiar with mental illness. And you don't want to see your own daughter is going to be suicidal. It's just the last thing. So the denial played a game. But in writing the book, it was helpful to me, and now it's helpful to others. Just this program itself is just getting the word out. And then with the movie coming out, I don't know when that's going to be, but they're thinking of doing that. The universe is now ready for this. It's there's no shame anymore. The stigma that there once was, this is a reality we have to face. Mental illness is here, and we have to find a way to treat it properly and effectively.
How has Pam's death affected what you do in your work?
Well, the first response to that, the one that just came up, is that I think I'm a better therapist. I was always considered by my clients and my colleagues, you know, a good therapist. But something grew out of that. And I guess it's a form of compassion that, even though I knew it on an intellectual level, I always had it. It came out in a more limbic way, the part of the brain that where the emotional seat of the brain is. And I think that when you go through an experience like this, you can become more effective to people that are going through it, because they can't look at you and say, well, you don't understand, because I have to say, but you know, I understand.
Right.
I've been through it too. So I think you become more effective to others.
Well, we're just about out of time. I want to go over this again, that Joan E. Childs will be moderating this series at Books and Books. You're Not Alone, Coping with Mental Illness, Four Perspectives. And the first in the series will be September 21st. You believe it's at 4 in the afternoon, a Sunday. That's right. Books and Books in Coral Gables. But her website is joanechilds.com, and I'm sure you'll have that information there.
Yes, it'll be posted on my events.
Okay. All right.
And my email as well.
Well, we want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a really, I think, important hour, and we wish you the best, and I'm glad to see that you're doing as well as you are.
I am so grateful to you for allowing me to come on and put this information out. So my thank yous to you, too.
Joan E. Childs, a practicing psychotherapist in South Florida since 1978. She's also an author and the founder of the Pamela Ann Glassman Educational Center, in cooperation with the Mental Health Association of South Florida, and a spokesperson for bipolar disorder and suicide. And she's written, Why Did She Jump? My Daughter's Battle with Bipolar Disorder. We thank you so much for being with us today. And we thank you for spending your time with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents. And you can follow me on Twitter at Bonnie Berman. And we apologize to the callers we couldn't get to and the emailers. We thank you for participating, though. Tomorrow at this time, we'll provide live coverage of the Miami-Dade County School Board meeting. We return on Thursday with investigative journalist Nina Teicholz. She's written The Big Fat Surprise, Why Butter, Meat, and Cheese Belong in a Healthy Diet. Also joining us for that discussion, Linda Gassenheimer and Dr. Neil Barnard. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a good one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now. It's coming up next from NPR News.